Good morning. In August of the year 2000, our daughter stopped by and asked me if I'd look after our granddaughter, Alyssa, who was six at the time, because she wanted to run a couple of errands. I said, sure, I'd love to. I loved looking after the grandchildren. So I invited Alyssa into the house, and we chatted for a while. We played some dolls. We probably played some puzzles. I can't remember all we did. Most likely we baked cookies, because I love to bake cookies with the grandchildren. A little while later, after we were done playing, I remembered that we had a big sow out in the barn that was going to have her babies anytime, and I thought maybe she'd like to go out and hold one of the baby pigs. So I asked her if she'd like to do that, and she said, yes, Gran, I would love to do that. So we went out to the barn and pushed the big door open, and there was this huge sow in the pen. She must have weighed 550 or 600 pounds, and there were a lot of babies around her. So I said, Alyssa, would you like to go in? She said, no, Gran, I don't think I would. I said, okay, I'll go in the pen and I'll get a little baby pig and I'll bring it out for you to hold. She thought that was a good idea. So I opened the pen, went in, shut the door behind me, and I went over and picked up one of the little babies. And before I knew it, the sow picked me up and tossed me to the other side of the pen. And I panicked. I was terrified. And I quickly said to Alyssa, very calmly, I said, go back into the house. I don't know if Gramps is there or not. I don't think so, but I want you to stay in the house, play with your toys. You can have a couple of cookies, but don't leave the house. So she said, okay, Gran, I will. She hurried out of the barn as if she sensed something was going to go terribly wrong. It did. The huge sow grabbed me again, and with rage, she just threw me to the back of the pen. And I remember bumping my head and getting a headache, and I thought, I was terrified. I didn't want to die in a pig pen of all places, and I just was terrified. And I didn't want Evan to come out and see me unconscious on the floor with holes chewed in me or anything. So I was just really afraid. So I prayed that I'd find a quick way out. Well, she grabbed me again with all the tenacity and fury a sow could give. And she threw me to the other side. And I was just petrified. I didn't know if this sow was hungry, whether she was ready to bite me and chew me or what she would do. So I just wanted to get out of there. And so one more time, she threw me near the gate. So I managed to get over the gate as quickly as I could and fell to the floor below. And I just thanked the Lord that I was on safe ground, and I was stunned and sore and exhausted. So I went into the house and there was nobody there. There was a note from my daughter that she had picked up her daughter. So I went to the hospital by myself because I had some wounds and I thought should be looked at. So I drove to the hospital, and on my way home, I saw my daughter pass the other way, so I was glad she was on her way. And I went into the house, and Evan was there. And he looked at me and said, what happened to you? And I said, well, I told him the story, and he said, you never go near baby pigs with a mother sow right there. I said, I know. I wasn't thinking. I was stupid. I could have had Alyssa killed in there. I don't know what I was thinking. I'm so sorry, babe. I just wasn't thinking at all. And he told me that sow was a particularly aggressive, mean sow, which he was afraid of himself. It was probably a Duroc, which is a very aggressive breed of pig. He gave me a hug and held me for a while and said everything would be okay. Well, if that were the case, what had precipitated moving that pig sow up to the top of the barn in the first place? Because all the rest of the sows were down in the main part of the barn in farrowing crates. Now, a farrowing crate is a metal crate within a larger pen, and it holds the sow in who's going to have her babies. And there's a place at the bottom of the gate where the babies can sort of sneak out and go under heat lamp or in some straw. And so it's also so the mother doesn't get up and lay down on the baby pigs when she gets back down again. That happens quite often, but not as often in a farrowing crate as it would have before. Now, I've often held baby pigs. I used to reach down and grab them, and the mother sow was there, and she couldn't hurt me, so I just never thought. Evan and I had been Ontario pork producers for 50 years. In fact, some of the first dates when we were still teenagers were in his grandfather's barn. He would ask me on a date. I said, where are we going? He said, well, we're going to my grandfather's barn because I've got some pigs there that I got to feed. And I said, oh, I'm a city girl. I'm not too sure I want to do this. He said, get some old clothes on. And I thought, what am I going to do there? So I got into the barn, and phew, It's an odor I hadn't smelt before. I'm so romantic. I must have really liked this guy. So I went in there and helped him feed some sows and feed some pigs and water some pigs. And I filled up some bins with some feed. And I swept the gangways, which are sort of sidewalks between the pens. And he also had some pigeons there and rabbits there that he was raising to go to the stockyards. And he had some ducks there to get the flies in the barn. So he was quite the entrepreneur. So I'm going to have a drink here. When we were married, we bought a farm just south of the Kitchener city limits on Fisher Hallman Road, which was then Regional Road 50, changed to Westmount Road, changed to Fisher Hallman Road. It was a back way into town, but now it's a major thoroughfare into town. And we had a farrow to finish operation, which means we had the pigs farrow have their babies. The babies were weaned, and then we raised them to market size, and we shipped them. So we had farrow to finish. It was a hot and sultry day one day in August of 2000, and Evan had taken his regular jaunt out to the barn when he quickly discovered that some of the baby pigs were either dead or dying. He was taken aback with what he saw and wondered what was causing this intrusive, unwanted invasion in his barn. Each successive visit was more disheartening than the first, and more piglets were dying, and Evan, with a despairing heart and a tear in his eye, had to pick up the baby pigs and take them out to the incinerator. The veterinarian came by and tried to assess what the problem was, but he couldn't really decide what it was. He recommended medication, but that didn't do anything. It seemed like healthy piglets in the morning were dead by the end of the day. He was losing 60% of his litters. And his litters were usually between 9 and 14 pigs, and sometimes even 20. So it was a good number that were dying. He took one of the piglets to the University of Guelph to have a post-mortem done on it to see if they could decide if it was a viral bacterial infection. They said it was bacterial, but they really didn't have any suggestions for him. Making something specific to his herd in the lab would be too costly an adventure. It would require a lot of research and development. So we decided to do what the other veterinarian said. He said, instead of putting the dead piglets into the incinerator, I want you to grind them up, put them in the mix mill, and mix them with the feed, feed them back to the breeding stock to make immunity for the pigs. So he thought, well, that might be an idea to do. So that's what he decided to do. He picked up the dead baby piglets that were dying, put them in the mix mill with the feed, and fed them back to the breeding stock. But that wasn't an easy fix because it takes a long time to pass through the herd to build up immunity. Evan has always been positive and encouraging, but this really impacted him. Each successive week brought more heaviness of heart, and the spring in his step had slowed to a crawl. Because so many piglets were dying, he wanted to test the theory. He thought if he put a big sow upstairs in the top of the barn, instead of with the other ones, maybe the baby pigs wouldn't have the disease that the other ones had. So it was all a test. It was an experiment on Evan's part to put the sow up there to see if her babies would have the same disease as the other ones. So that's why she was all alone upstairs. It was an experiment. But why such a fierce and aggressive one? He forgot to tell me that this pig was an aggressive pig. And he was on his way out to check on the sow when I arrived home from the hospital. His spirit was so downcast the following Sunday that he had no desire to worship. But the Lord was planning on having him worship beyond what he ever could have imagined. In the late afternoon, there was a knock on our front door. I went to answer it, and there was this man in his 30s or so standing there. He looked disheveled and somewhat disoriented. I didn't see his vehicle, so I asked him where he came from. He said, "That way," pointing north. "No, that way," pointing in the other direction. So I thought, this is interesting. So I immediately knew that God had sent him to us, but I was unaware of the purpose of his visit. And all he asked for was a glass of water. I quickly invited him inside, down the hall, into the kitchen, calling for Evan all the while. He was downstairs. We sat down at the table. Evan welcomed our stranger. We gave him his glass of water and a meal. He told us his name was Paul Williams. He asked what our names were. We told him what our names were. He said, what is this place? And Evan said it was a pig farm. We have little pigs all the way up to the mummies and daddies, the sows and the boars. He nodded and asked a few more questions, and Evan answered as best he knew how. The man was obviously mentally challenged, and after finishing his meal, he said, you're going to take me home, right? Evan chuckled and said, yes, we'll take you home. So the three of us got into our vehicle, but we thought, would he know the way? Surprisingly, he knew exactly the way. He told Evan where to drive, which road to turn on. At every turn, we soon pulled into the driveway of a lovely home in Bridgeport, 23 kilometers away from our home in the country. We dropped him off, and we began to drive away, and we thought, maybe he doesn't belong here. Maybe we should just drop him off. So we pulled back in, and a woman came out and hugged him warmly, and she came over to the car crying. She said, where did you find him? I've been so worried about him. Where did you end up being? And we said, well, we're 23 kilometers away in the country on the other side of Kitchener. She was shocked because the night before he told her, Mom, I got to get up very early in the morning because I have somewhere to go. He usually walked around Bridgeport and people there knew him, but if they didn't, they would cross the road or turn the other way because he was one of the least of these. So she also told us that he had a sister that was married with some children, but she developed this brain disorder, which changed her personality completely. In fact, she could no longer look after her children, and it was most difficult to cope. A little while later, she passed away. Paul was her second child, and he developed the same brain disorder, and he was a successful plumber. And so she was in tears and said, I hope my oldest one doesn't have the same brain disorder. Well, Evan began to cry uncontrollably, and she said, whatever is the matter? He said, I'm losing my little pigs with an unknown disease, but you're losing your children to an unknown disease. So both of them shared some crying and some tears, and we started off on our way home just thanking the Lord that he had provided such a place for us to go and hear that he was taking care of us. We were on our way home, and it was a long and arduous journey, and we thought Paul had come all this way. He could have stopped at any place along the way. He could have stopped at a convenience store or a gas station or any home on any street. But he continued his long and arduous journey until he reached his destination, our front door, and simply asked for a glass of water. So Evan is going to share a little bit of how this affected him.
The mosaic of life is pieced together from all kinds of events and choices. And whatever affects one person directly has a ripple effect on many others indirectly. When Ann asked me to be part of this sharing this morning, I confess that I'd rather be at home looking after a barn full of pigs than standing up here doing this. But I believe that God is in everything that happens, orchestrating and present in ways that we can't even explain or begin to understand. And as our faith in him grows, the best we can do is accept his leading, his ways, and just be grateful that he loves us so much that he's willing to journey with us as fallible and as mortal as we are. We truly are weak. But he is strong. Isaiah 55, 8 to 10 has a passage that I'd just like to share. Starting verse. My thoughts are completely different from yours, says the Lord, and my ways are far beyond anything you could imagine. For just as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. The rain and the snow come down from the heavens and stay on the ground to water the earth, and they cause the grain to grow, producing seed for the farmer and bread for the hungry. It is the same with my word. I send it out, and it always produces fruit. It will accomplish all I want it to, and it will prosper everywhere I send it. I find a great deal of comfort that I serve a God who has thoughts that are higher than my thoughts and ways that are higher than my ways. Paul's visit turned from being kind of a confusing and awkward meeting to one of rejoicing that God really was concerned about what was happening in the Williams family as well as ours. We soon discovered the Williams shared a faith in God, and although the outlook for their son was very bleak, God used him to be a blessing to us, a refreshment to us, to give us a new outlook on life. It kind of gives one pause because we're living in an age where assisted suicide is on the table, and God can use people right to the very end, even though they're not together, even though they're losing it. And Paul was certainly an example of that, that even though he was dying, God still had a mission for him. There are... There are times when life gets kind of heavy, and I know that is, I'm not alone in that. And when things like this come along, and since 2000, it's happened many times, and it happened many times before that. We raised our children on gospel music, and the Cathedrals was one of my favorite groups, and they had a song that, and I sing it often, and it kind of goes that sometimes the little boy in me still wants to crawl on his father's knee when the world outside seems too big for me. When the pain's too much for me to hide and my fondest dreams have all but died, he always understands me when I cry, hold me. Hold me, I'm so afraid of the storm. Hold me, I'll be safe in my father's arms. One week after this mountaintop experience, I made one of the dumbest choices I have ever made in my life. And I've made a few, to be sure. And this was even dumber than not making Anne aware of what she was getting into when she walked in the barn. I never saw that coming. I had been working with a vet to resolve the issues that were in the barn, and with some exciting success. And I had gone into the house to grab a bite to eat, and before going back into the barn to continue tending to the piglets, I encountered my dad standing in the yard looking up at the pear tree. And for the past few days, he had been kind of hinting that he would like to pick the pears. Interpret that meant, Evan, would you please help me pick the pears? Well, it was a big old pear tree. And how does a farmer go about picking pears in a pear tree? Front end bucket. And that's what he went out and brought the front end bucket in. I climbed up and proceeded to pick a few bushels of pears, and I thought we had plenty of pears, but as I was looking at the tree, it went up quite a bit higher and I couldn't reach way up there. So that's when I got this brilliant idea that maybe we should add a ladder to the scenario. Well, I remember picking a few pears and getting up and down, and I guess I just kept getting up higher and higher, and the whole concept kind of went out from under me. Now, this big old pear tree was right beside a cement driveway, and the next thing I remember, I was kind of coming to in the hospital. I had fallen down and smashed my entire left side. I broke all my ribs. My lungs were collapsed. My back was broken. And of course, I had no idea what was going on. I woke up and wondered, how in the world, what am I doing here? And I was strapped to a gurney all the way down, so I couldn't even move. And I was made aware that the surgeon, the person in charge, didn't want me moving because they feared I was paralyzed. And so they had me strapped in there pretty tightly. And then I looked around and tried to gather myself, I realized I was hooked up to all these machines, and I really couldn't get my head around everything, but I was gaining more awareness, and Ann had been called in. Now, Ann described earlier how it was a smell she had to get used to. Excuse me a second. As I said, before I started picking pears, I was working in the barn. And she had no problem finding me in the hospital. She just kind of followed the odor. I often wondered what everybody thought I was into. As I was laying there, and Ann had finally come into the room, and she was staying with me. And as the evening unfolded, she decided to go home. And in hindsight, she said she should have known better. But she barely got home, and the doctors called and said, "You better call the family in, because he's not going to make it through the night." I guess I had developed a pulmonary embolism, and the machines that were hooked up to all the things went cattywampus on the machine, and Ann reminded me after that she knew something was wrong when she went home, and she should have stayed because my color, I was all gray, and I just didn't look right. So they were rushing me down to the CT machine, and I had become quite aware at this point that I was in pretty rough shape. Like I wasn't gonna survive. And I leaned over to Ann when I realized that my time might be up, and I said to her, "Ann, it's okay. I'm ready to go." And she said, hang on a second, I'll take it. She said, "But I'm not ready to let you go." And I remember being wheeled into the CT machine, thinking, this is it, I'm dying. But I didn't sense anything. Like, I kind of thought death would have a pain factor involved with it or something. But I had absolute calm and peace. Like, I was not afraid of what was about to happen. I remember a couple of weeks ago, a few weeks ago, Becky Becky was here sharing, and she was mentioning about the Israelite people being caught between the Red Sea and the army coming and the mountains, and they were hemmed in. And I confess that's kind of the way I felt. And the Bible says that death is our final enemy. And as I was laying there getting wheeled into this CT, I said, this is my casket. You know, I'm going to die in here. And I felt absolutely no panic. I felt complete calm. And I was kind of waiting, and I came out the other end of this machine, and the people attending were starting to rejoice and said, it's gone. His color's back. Like, when the family was called in, my son said the trip in was a Pentecostal prayer meeting. I guess it kind of alludes to what we were sharing earlier, that I'm thankful to my family that they prayed for me, and God decided that I needed more time on this earth. Since the year of 2000, the 23rd Psalm has become a solace to me, a go-to place. And a reminder the effects of all this. I've come out of it pretty unscathed. I've got this hybrid arm that's left, that the nerves are all shot in. That's a source of frustration at times, but most of the time it's a reminder that I've been redeemed for a few more years. And I want to share with you what the 23rd Psalm has become to mean to me. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness. Now, I've come to realize that you don't have to fall out of a pear tree to be in green pastures and calm waters. I become fully aware that that's the time I need to give to Him every day. I need to spend time with Him every day to refresh me, to lead me, to guide me. And yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for He will be with me. I've come to know that to be so real and so true. That His desire is to not only be with me, but be with me to the end. Your rod and your staff will comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. This week, Ann baked some orange bow ties. I'm running on orange bow ties this morning. They're delicious. And even in our toughest times, our toughest moments, our hardest times, God has something delicious for us in that. He sent Paul. Paul was a delicious refreshment. And as I often think of the Bible as being a recipe book, there's a recipe in there for us to be something delicious for someone else. When I think of the people who were affected indirectly because of the stupid mistake I made, I got my brother. He came to the fore and spearheaded a group of people to look after things while I was recovering. That was something delicious for me at the time. Now, it took four guys to do what I was doing, though, but just saying. And then there were the people who came to my assistance right at the start, the normal responders, the fire department, the paramedics, and the police who came rushing in. And then there were all the healthcare workers that I put out of their way just because of a stupid decision that I had made. And even thinking back of that time when I was going through the CT scan, I was thinking, I deserve this. I deserve to die. That was really a stupid thing to do. But all of those people at that point in time were something delicious for me, something that really, and food is often, we gather around all our events and food is shared. And as I think of it, there's going to be a banquet table prepared in heaven for us to enjoy. It's all a lot of things that are overwhelming. But the psalm ends with, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. The mosaic of life is pieced together from all kinds of events and choices. Why not choose Jesus? Why not allow Jesus to be a part of the mosaic of your life? I have a song I'd like to share with you at this time. And it speaks of what Jesus brings to the table for us. He giveth grace and mercy and peace. And part of this song, in the chorus it says, He giveth and giveth and giveth again. As it turns out, I needeth and needeth and needeth again. And I'm sure we all are in that.
He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labors increase. To added afflictions, He addeth His mercy to multiply trials. Multiply peace. Well, His love has no limits, and His grace has no measure, His power has no boundary known unto man. For out of His infinite riches in Jesus, He giveth and giveth. Our store of endurance, when our strength has failed, ere the day is half done, when we've reached the end of our hoarded resources, our Father's full giving is only begun.
Want to thank Jesus that he, thank you, Jesus, that in our need, you are refreshment, you are encouragement. Thank you for this body of believers that does such a great job of encouraging. And I just pray that as we journey together, we will learn how to become something delicious for those around us. Amen.